Greetings, this is Jeff Riddle, pastor of Christ Reformed Baptist Church in Louisa, Virginia. And this is another in this series of readings from and brief notes and commentary upon Augustine of Hippo's Harmony of the Evangelist. In this episode, we're going to be looking at Book 1, chapters 33 through 35. Here, let's begin with chapter 33, which has as its heading a statement in opposition to those who make the complaint that the bliss of human life has been impaired by the entrance of Christian times. Finally, as to the complaint which they make with respect to the impairing of the bliss of human life by the entrance of Christian times, if they only peruse the books of their own philosophers, who reprehend those very things which are now being taken out of their way, in spite of all their unwillingness and murmuring, they will indeed find that great praise is due to the times of Christ. For what diminution is made in their happiness, unless it be in what they most basely and luxuriously abused to the great injury of their Creator? Or unless, perchance, it be the case that evil times originate in such circumstances as these, in which throughout almost all states the theaters are falling, and with them too the dens of vice and the public profession of iniquity, yea, altogether the forums and the cities in which the demons used to be worshipped are falling. How comes it then that they are falling, unless it be in consequence of the failure of those very things, in the lustful and sacrilegious use of which they were constructed? Did not their own Cicero, when commending a certain actor of the name of Roscius, call him a man so clever as to be the only one worthy enough to make it due for him to come upon the stage? And yet again, so good a man as to be the only one so worthy as to make it due for him not to approach it. What else did he disclose with such remarkable clearness by this saying, but the fact that the stage was so base there that a person was under the greater obligation not to connect himself with it, in proportion as he was a better man than most? And yet their gods were pleased with such things of shame, as he deemed fit only to be removed to a distance from good men. But we have also an open confession of the same Cicero, where he says that he had to appease Flora, the mother of sports, by frequent celebration, in which sport such an excess of vice is wont to be exhibited, that, in comparison with them, others are respectable, from engaging in which, nevertheless, good men are prohibited. Who is this mother Flora, and what manner of goddess is she, who is thus conciliated and propitiated by a practice of a vice indulged in with more than usual frequency and with looser reins? How much more honorable now was it for a Roscius to step upon the stage than for Cicero to worship a goddess of this kind? If the gods of the Gentile nations are offended because the supplies are lessened which are instituted for the purpose of such celebrations, it is apparent of what character those must be who are delighted with such things. But if, on the other hand, the gods themselves in their wrath diminish these supplies, their anger yields us better services than their placability. Wherefore, let these men either confute their own philosophers, who have reprehended the same practices on the side of wanton men, or else let them break in pieces those gods of theirs, who have made such demands upon their worshippers, if indeed they still find any such deities either to break in pieces or to conceal. But let them cease from their blasphemous habit of charging Christian times with the failure of their true prosperity, a prosperity indeed so used by them that we're sinking into all that is base and hurtful, lest thereby they be only putting us all the more emphatically in mind of reasons for the ampler praise of the power of Christ. Chapter 34, which is titled Epilogue to the Preceding. Much more might I say on this subject, were it not that the requirements of the task which I have undertaken compel me to conclude this book and revert to the object originally proposed, when indeed I took in hand to solve those problems of the Gospels which meet us where the four evangelists, as it seems to certain critics, fail to harmonize with each other, by setting forth to the best of my ability the particular designs which they severally have in view. I was met first by the necessity of discussing a question which some are accustomed to bring before us, the question, namely, as to the reason why we cannot produce any writings composed by Christ himself. For their aim is to get him credited with the writing of some other composition, I know not of what sort, which may be suitable to their inclinations, and with having indulged in no sentiments of antagonism to their gods, but rather with having paid respect to them in a kind of magical worship. And their wish is also to get it believed that his disciples not only gave a false account of him when they declared him to be the God by whom all things were made, while he was really nothing more than a man, although certainly a man of the most exalted wisdom, but also that they taught with regard to these gods of theirs something different from what they had themselves learned from him. This is how it happens that we have been engaged preferentially in pressing them with arguments concerning the God of Israel, who is now worshipped by all nations through the medium of the Church of the Christians, who is also subverting their sacrilegious vanities the world over, exactly as he announced by the mouth of the prophet so long ago, and who has now fulfilled those predictions by the name of Christ, in whom he had promised that all nations should be blessed. And from all this they ought to understand that Christ could neither have known nor taught anything else with regard to their gods than what was enjoined and foretold by the God of Israel through the agency of the prophets of his, by whom he promised and ultimately sent this very Christ, in whose name, according to the promise given to the fathers, when all nations were pronounced blessed, it has come to pass that this same God of Israel should be called the God of the whole earth. By this, too, they ought to see that his disciples did not depart from the doctrine of their master when they forbade the worship of the gods of the Gentiles with the view of preventing us from addressing our supplications to insensate images or having fellowship with demons or from serving the creature rather than the creator with the homage of religious worship. Chapter 35, titled, Of the Fact that the Mystery of a Mediator Was Made Known to Those Who Lived in Ancient Times by the Agency of Prophecy, and it is now declared to us in the Gospel. Wherefore, seeing that Christ himself is that wisdom of God, by whom all things were created, and considering that no rational intelligences, whether of angels or of men, receive wisdom except by participation in this wisdom, wherewith we are united by that Holy Spirit, through whom charity is shed abroad in our hearts, which Trinity at the same time constitutes one God. Divine providence, having respect to the interests of mortal men, whose time-bound life was held engaged in things which rise into being and die, decreed that this same wisdom of God, assuming into the unity of his person the nature of man, in which he might be born according to the conditions of time, and live and die and rise again, should utter and perform and bear and sustain things congruous to our salvation, and thus in exemplary fashion show at once to men on earth the way for a return to heaven, and to those angels who are above us the way to retain their position in heaven. For unless also in the nature of the reasonable soul and under the conditions of an existence in time something came newly into being, that is to say, unless that began to be which previously was not, there could never be any passing from a life of utter corruption and folly into one of wisdom and true goodness. And thus, as truth in the contemplative lives in the enjoyment of things eternal, while faith in the believing is what is due to things which are made, man is purified through that faith which is conversant with temporal things, in order to his being made capable of receiving the truth of things eternal. For one of their noblest intellects, the philosopher Plato, in the treatise which is named the Timaeus, speaks also to this effect: as eternity is to that which is made, so truth to faith. Those two belong to the things above, namely eternity and truth. These two things belong to the things below, namely that which is made, faith, that which is made and faith. In order, therefore, that we may be called off from the lowest objects and be led up again to the highest, and in order also that what is made may attain to the eternal, we must come through faith to truth. And because all contraries are reduced to unity by some middle factor, and because also the iniquity of time alienated us from the righteousness of eternity, there was need of some mediatorial righteousness of a temporal nature, which mediatizing factor might be temporal on the side of those lowest objects, but also righteous on the side of those highest. and thus, by adapting itself to the former without cutting itself from the latter, might bring back those lowest objects to the highest. Accordingly, Christ was named the mediator between God and men, who stood between the immortal God and mortal man, as being himself both God and man, who reconciled man to God, who continued to be what he formerly was, but was made also what he formerly was not. And the same person is for us at once the center of the said faith in things that are made, and the truth in things eternal. This great and unutterable mystery, this kingdom and priesthood, was revealed by prophecy to the men of ancient times, and is now preached by the gospel to their descendants. For it behoved that, at some period or other, that should be made good among all nations, which for a long time had been promised through the medium of a single nation. Accordingly, he who sent the prophets before his own descent also dispatched the apostles after his ascension. Moreover, in virtue of the man assumed by him, he stands to all his disciples in the relation of the head to the members of his body. Therefore, when those disciples have written matters which he declared and spake to them, it ought not by any means to be said that he has written nothing himself, since the truth is that his members have accomplished only what they became acquainted with by the repeated statements of the head. For all that he was minded to give for our perusal on the subject of his own doings and sayings, he commanded to be written by those disciples, whom he thus used as if they were his own hands. Whoever apprehends this correspondence of unity and this concordant service of the members, all in harmony in the discharge of diverse offices under the head, will receive the account which he gets in the gospel through the narratives constructed by the disciples, in the same kind of spirit in which he might look upon the actual hand of the Lord himself, which he bore in that body, which was made his own, were he to see it engaged in the act of writing. For this reason, let us now rather proceed to examine in the real character of those passages in which these critics suppose the evangelist to have given contradictory accounts, a thing which only those who fail to understand the matter aright can fancy to be the case. So that when these problems are solved, it may also be made apparent that the members in that body have preserved a befitting harmony in the unity of the body itself, not only by identifying in sentiment, but also by constructing records consonant with that identity. Here ends the reading of Book 1, chapters 33, 34, and 35. And let's move on to a few brief notes and commentary. First, on Book 1, Chapter 33, titled A Statement in Opposition to Those Who Make the Complaint that the Bliss of Human Life Has Been Impaired by the Entrance of Christian Times. Augustine defends Christianity in this chapter against critics who charge that its rise has impaired what he calls the bliss of human life. He makes reference to the fact that the triumph of Christianity has indeed resulted in the decline of theaters, the closing of dens of vices, and the celebrations of some sports. But he notes that the pagan philosophers had condemned many of the vices that took place in these places. Only those of low character would protest the diminishment of such things. Christianity has not brought about the failure of true prosperity, but it has rescued society from sinking into all that is base and hurtful. We'll move on now to Book 1 and Chapter 34, which is titled Epilogue to the Preceding. Nearing now the end of Book 1, Augustine returns to his purpose for writing this book. He wants to show that the Gospels can be harmonized, that they're not contradictory. He adds that the Gospels are sufficient without there being any extant writings from Jesus himself. The disciples did not give a false account of the life of Jesus, and Jesus was not a mere man, albeit a man with exalted wisdom. The prophecies of the Old Testament predicted that Jesus would forbid the worship of the pagan gods. His disciples, in composing the Gospels, did not depart from the teachings of Jesus or the teachings of the prophets. Now, let's move on to Book 1 and Chapter 35, titled of the fact that the mystery of the mediator was made known to those who lived in ancient times by the agency of prophecy, as it is now declared to us in the gospel. Augustine begins by noting that Christ himself is the wisdom of God of which the prophet spoke. Drawing on Plato's Timaeus, he notes a distinction between things above, eternity and truth, and things below, things made and faith. Christ is the mediator between these two realms. He is the perfect mediator between God and man because he is both God and man. Christ is the center of faith, things made, and of truth, things eternal. This mystery was spoken about by the prophets. Christ now stands as the head of the body. There's no need to have anything written by Jesus, for when his disciples wrote, it was as though Jesus himself was engaged in the act of writing. So in the Gospels, we can, as it were, see the Jesus writing in his own hand through his disciples. In conclusion now, with this last segment, Book 1 is brought to a conclusion. It has 35 chapters. Augustine responds in these closing chapters with a final apologetic thrust against pagan critics, defending Christianity against the charge of being puritanical. He reinforces the fact that his goal in this work is to demonstrate that the Gospels can be harmonized and that they accurately reflect the teaching of Jesus. Though we have no writings from Jesus himself, the Gospels are sufficient to convey what Jesus taught. And so with that, we bring again Book 1 to its conclusion. I hope that this episode has been helpful to those who are listening and have been following this series. And I'll look forward to speaking to you in the next episode when we begin Book 2. Till then, take care and God bless.